Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... At the risk of being parochial, we're dedicating this pre-election episode of Haaretz Weekly to the Israeli and Jewish angles of Tuesday's US presidential showdown. Joining me in the studio to discuss the special relationship between Israel and the United States, we have two special guests. How are you, Chemi Shalev?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Nervous ahead of Tuesday? Excited? Nauseous?
No, I'm nervous because of this interview.
Katan alecha, as we say. Hello, too, to Amir Tibon. How are you, Amir?
Hi, great to be here again.
Looking forward to Tuesday's Festival of Democracy?
I'm going to be working the all-night shift here at the Haaretz desk, so I'm definitely gearing up towards that.
Stale pizza and bad coffee.
Whatever they bring us, basically. Uh-huh.
Okay, guys, so a softball question to begin with. Who's going to win?
I don't know. If I live in a rational world and I assume that things that I knew or had any significance, like the things that we know about the world, then Joe Biden should win. But we, first of all, we have our trauma of 2016, so nobody is going to. And you can see a pathway that Trump can get to the 270 electors. So. As long as you can see a pathway for him, you can't rule out the possibility that he will win. But if I had to put money, if I had no choice, I would have to put it on Biden because all the objective indications are that he will win.
Amir, with a gun to your head?
In 2016, I was very scared of a Trump victory. And I also bet money on a Trump victory because I said, if the world is coming to an end, let me make a profit out of it. I really believed that he was going to take it. I thought that the polls were too close and that people misinterpreted Hillary's small margins. I feel much better today. I sleep much better right now. In 2016, in the 10 days after the Comey letter, I couldn't get any sleep, really. I was sure that the world was heading towards a crazy situation. I don't feel that kind of tension right now. I really do believe that Biden looks in a much better position. I agree with Chemi. Trump can still win. It's not it's not out of the question. But it would be a much larger shock than 2016. Obviously, the two most commonly quoted, I'm not saying anything original here, but the two most commonly quoted explanations, Hillary Clinton's margin in the national popular vote at this point was around 2-3%, and she won by 2%. Which in the electoral college system is just not enough for a Democrat today. Biden's current margin is 7-8%. That's, three times almost as much. It's much harder to lose with that kind of margin. Also in 2016, if you looked at what the American pollsters call the generic ballot question, are you going to vote for a Democrat or a Republican for Congress in your district? Mm. It was almost even. And by the way, the polls were right. I think the Republicans won the congressional contest by 1 point in 2016. Right now, in all of the polls, there is a kind of consensus around the issue. On the generic ballot question, the Democrats have an advantage of 6-9 points, which is pretty similar to how they won the midterm elections in 2018 with an 8-point margin. You combine those two statistics, it looks much, much more difficult for Trump to win. I think if he does win, it's going to be the end of the polling industry.
Are the polls any more reliable than they were 4 years ago? I mean, as followers of Israeli elections, we've learned not to trust the polls, right?
First of all, I think the polls are being maligned a bit.
Yes.
They were within a percent of the actual result in 2016. They failed to take into account these razor-thin margins in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan. And I hope one day we'll learn exactly how that came about, because I still don't know that it was completely unfettered elections there. But I think I still trust the polls. I don't think the world has gone completely crazy. And it is a scientific endeavor, contrary to what people may believe. What I don't know, and what I think, even though the pollsters have made a lot of modifications, they learned their lessons from 2016. They made all sorts of modifications. There are still some unknown factors. One is, who are the people who are refusing to cooperate with the polls?
Right.
And the assumption is that these are Trump voters. I'm not so sure about that, because I think that if you live in Trump country and you want to vote for Biden, you're not going to whisper it even to a pollster. And the question is there any connection between the enthusiasm that Trump is generating in his rallies, which he's doing 3-4 a day, and the enthusiasm of the entire Trump bloc? So if there is a direct connection, then I think we shouldn't rule out the possibility that on Election Day, Trump voters will indeed outpace Biden voters, perhaps by margins that we can't anticipate. Other than that, I think we can trust the polls and should trust the polls. And we can take our own example. You know, say in 1996, when Netanyahu won by 0.5%, and everybody said it was the greatest failure ever. But 0.5%, if you make a mistake of 1%, that's the ball game. And the same thing is true in America. Because of the Electoral College, you can win, even though I think the figure is 5%. Trump, even if he's trailing by 5% in the national polls, can still take the Electoral College. It's very difficult to give an exact prophecy when you have those conditions around.
In the Israel example, we had three elections in Israel in 2019 and 2020, three elections within a period of a year and a half. In the first election, the polls were kind of off, I would say. Mm-hmm. They didn't capture the strengths of the pro-Netanyahu bloc, which won 60 seats. But in the two subsequent elections, in September 2019 and then in March 2020, the polls were pretty accurate. They showed pretty much what Netanyahu was going to get, and not just Likud, but the entire right-wing religious bloc, getting 55 seats in the election of September and 58 in the election of March. So even in Israel, sometimes the polls can do right. And I agree with Chemi, a miss of a 0.5% is hard to judge people by.
Mm. Well, Israeli pollsters had plenty of time to practice. They've had three elections.
That's true. But in the U.S., I have to say, in the midterm elections, which, it's more recent than 2016. And of course, you cannot compare completely a presidential race to a congressional only race. But the polls were pretty good in 2018, except for one state where there was a pretty big disappointment, which was Florida, where the polls showed that the Democratic candidates for the Senate and the governorship were leading, and then the races went to Republicans again by very small margins, about 0.5% or maybe even 0.3. But there was also a polling mistake in 2018 in two interesting states for this year, actually three, that was against the Democrats. Nevada, Arizona, two states where the polls showed a Republican advantage in the Senate race, and both races went to the Democrats. And in Texas, the polls showed a very strong margin for Ted Cruz in the Senate race against Beto O'Rourke, and it ended a 2% victory. So there are examples that you can take for either direction. Overall, I think, again, an 8-point margin in the national popular vote is different than a 2-3-point margin. It would be a much bigger failure of the pollsters if Trump would win the Electoral College in a situation where Biden gets, let's say, now 3 or 4%. It would be a much bigger miss than what we had in 2016.
Amir is right. In Israel, we do, based on our empirical experience, the polls usually, if they make a mistake, it's in favor of the left. They make the left stronger. In America, that's not necessarily the case, and we have to remember 2012. In 2012, the final RCP average of between Obama and Romney was a 1% advantage to Obama, but he won 4%, and that is a massive mistake. But a 3%, out of 4, that's a massive mistake. But because they had said that Obama had an advantage, nobody paid attention to the fact that they had gotten it so wrong. So in America, things can work both ways. I wouldn't assume that if the polls are mistaken, they're necessarily mistaken in Trump's favor.
One poll that does seem fairly consistent is the poll of Israeli preferences. no change. Israelis and their leaders prefer 4 more years of Trump, unequivocally. A new I-24 news poll found 63% of Israelis say that Trump would be better for Israel than Joe Biden. This kind of reminds me a little bit of the scene from Life of Brian. What has Trump ever done for us? Apart from the embassy, Jerusalem, the Golan, normalization deals, creeping annexation, and F-22 stealth fighters, can you really blame Israelis for believing that Trump is the best friend that they've ever had in the White House? The gifts just keep coming.
We can argue about the gifts. I don't think some of them, I don't think, are that precious as Israelis believe they are. But yes, you can understand why Israelis support Trump. It's not only because he has been, he has made these gestures, and it's not only because Netanyahu has praised Trump as the greatest friend Israel ever had. It's also because of the demonization that has been ongoing in Israel for the past 12 years about Obama, and by extension or by association, this applies to Biden now. Biden is seen as a sort of extension of Obama, and people in Israel think Obama was a bad for us, and therefore Biden is going to be bad for us. But I wish that the only explanation was that he's good, you know, that he's good for Israel, and we don't care. I don't think that's the case.
Arguably good for Israel.
As I said, I'm sorry to say, I think there is a real support for Trump, not only because he supports Israel, but because I think a lot of Israelis like his style, like his antagonism towards political correctness. His enemies are the people that he hates are the people that a lot of Israelis hate. You know, he has a fight with Europe. Israelis don't like Europe. He fights liberals, and these are, and we have a country
he
with
fights
a,
American Jews
with a decidedly exactly with a decidedly pro right public opinion, and they support Trump for a lot of reasons, some of which are valid, some of which I wish were did not exist.
I think when it comes to support for Trump in Israel, I agree with Chemi's analysis. I also think that this doesn't mean Israelis would necessarily support Trump's agenda if in the United States, meaning a politician in Israel that would run on Trump's in domestic agenda, I don't think would get very far.
He
wants
reject.
To cancel Obamacare. We in Israel have something that is much more progressive than Obamacare in terms of healthcare, right? It's more like a Bernie Sanders plan, the Kupat Cholim, it's socialized medicine. I don't think many Israelis would vote for a party that would want to cancel that. Even the most right-wing, you know, libertarian strands in Israeli politics are not actively talking about killing the public medical coverage that we have.
But they are talking about building walls and keeping immigrants out.
Yeah, okay, but again, I don't think, first of all, Trump is not talking about immigration in this campaign. For some reason, I don't know, he's not really making such a big, maybe because he didn't build the wall.
What happened to the caravan?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, on guns, I don't think many Israelis who like Trump would want to import. Some would, but I think the majority would not want to import the American gun laws and gun culture into Israel. We don't have people, you know, kids bringing guns to school. We're fine with soldiers having guns in the streets. We're used to it, but it's different. And also, on the even on the environmental issue, the kind of policies that he's been advancing that are really going to cause a lot of damage in the long run, I don't think they would be popular even with some right-wing voters in Israel. So I agree with Chemi, the support is mostly based, first of all, on his agenda regarding Israel that is popular with more right-wing leaning and religious Israelis. And second, because of the antagonism, the hatred towards people that are perceived as enemies. But if he would run in Israel with the kind of agenda he's running with in the United States, he would not get very far. And I think that explains some of the difference between Israeli, it's not everything, but some of the different approach between Israelis and American Jews. American Jews actually have to live also with the domestic consequences of his presidency.
You mentioned American Jews, and we know that they and Israelis are backing, you know, very different horses in this race. And, and that's just one of the issues that's driving a wedge between Israel and Jewish Americans. As Israelis and as Jews in Israel, should we be worried by this? I mean, even tragedies like the Tree of Life shooting 2 years ago failed to unify the two camps, right?
If you're asking whether we should be worried, I don't think there's any doubt. First of all, if you care about the concept of world Jewry, if you care about the relationship between Israel and American Jews, you cannot but not be worried. The only way not to be worried is by ignorance. If you don't know what's going on, you're not worried. This is just a symptom or a manifestation, the diametric differences between how Israelis view Trump and how Americans view Trump is a manifestation of the gap that has been growing between them for years, and which accelerated in the wake of Netanyahu's fight against Obama and the Iran nuclear deal, which drove a wedge. And the fact that Netanyahu is Trump's BFF and that he is the world leader most identified with Trump, at least among democracies, I think is something that really repels American Jews. And it will be interesting to see how that will influence relationships if Biden wins and if Jews are called to once again supposedly rally around Netanyahu. I'm not sure that's going to be so easy to carry out.
Not, to coin a phrase, not all Jews, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, last week, Mark Zell, the vice president of Republicans overseas, said that trying to convince Jewish voters in the U.S. to support Trump is a useless task. And I want to read you his quote here because I think it's fascinating. In every cycle of American elections, he said, the Jewish people in the U.S. have supported a Democratic candidate, no matter who that was. And he goes on to say that Jewish people speak of Trump as if he was the devil incarnate. And this is why we're not spending time to convince anyone of them. Is this the new version of screw them, they don't vote for us?
Well, you could also see it as a, you know, rational calculation. If I was in charge of Trump's campaign coffers and I had to decide where I'm going to spend my money, I wouldn't spend it on American Jews. Because of the antipathy, because of the history, because of the tiny numbers, I think that this has come as a great surprise to Trump. Whatever he's been doing for Israel, hasn't changed anything in the vote of the American Jews, and he's frustrated about it. And I'm assuming that at one point or another, we're going to hear about it from him in a way that probably won't be pleasant. He already makes unpleasant remarks about American Jews, but he's burning inside. Because this is like they're being ungrateful to him.
Even despite this ingratitude, he keeps on giving the gifts, right? I mean, what, for example, was U.S. Ambassador Friedman doing at Ariel University last week?
There's a person called Sheldon Adelson, who is the patron exactly. of Ariel University. I don't think you need any more answers.
but this is significant, right?
I think most of this stuff is really not about the American Jewish vote. It's about Jewish donors. Adelson is the most prominent of them, but not the only one. And it's about evangelical voters, who are a much more important voting bloc for Trump, have a much larger presence in the important swing states, and vote much more based on policies related to Israel than American Jews, who vote on domestic priorities. And even if there's a president that most American Jews might agree is doing good things for Israel, that doesn't mean they're going to vote for someone who wants to cancel Obamacare. It's just not it's not going to tip the scales. And I think it's unfortunate that none of the Jewish advisors around Donald Trump have taken the time to explain this to him and basically put an end to his frustration and disappointment with the Jewish community.
I mean, the fact that the Trump administration is tacitly, creepingly allowing the annexation to go ahead, does this put to rest the argument that Netanyahu capitulated to Trump by agreeing to shelve the annexation in exchange for normalization deals?
There's this period of time that we're not talking about, which is the transition. Let's assume that Trump loses. Mm. We have 3 months, and we have a Trump, if we assume that he didn't, you know, carry out a coup or something, he's angry, he's frustrated, he wants to get back at everybody. And if you ask me, you know, an annexation is like thumbing your finger at the whole world. I see a very good chance that these 3 months will be they won't be as monotonous as transitions sometimes are, and they will be very significant for Israel. They could be very significant for Israel. And I remind you that the right has convinced itself that Obama in the Security Council resolution in December or January, that he already violated the rule that you don't carry out major policies during the transition.
Right, with the UN,
and I'm sure that
resolution
Trump wants
condemning
to outdo
settlements.
Him. Mm. He wants to outdo Obama, and he wants to do something even more spectacular. So those 3 months could be very significant. Well, an annexation, I think it could be.
But the question is, course, does Bibi go along with
it? Exactly.
Because if there is a Biden victory, does Bibi want to start the relationship on that kind of footing? Mm. And Bibi and Biden, I have to say, there is a potential for it not to be as bad as Bibi and Obama. I mean, Netanyahu, I remember an interview with Netanyahu after the 2016 election, after Trump has already won. And it's clear that he's going to be sworn in, where Netanyahu refers to Joe Biden as Yedidi, you know, my friend. Mm. Not Haveri, not a close friend, but Yedidi, right. You know, a relative friend. And I remember that even after the Iran deal passed, in all of the terrible skirmish between Obama and Netanyahu, in early 16, when it became apparent that Biden was not running for president in that election, there was a moment where there was a very public photograph of Biden and Ron Dermer, Netanyahu's ambassador and closest advisor in Washington, hanging out together and making a statement of being seen together and photographed together to show that at least with some elements of the administration and the Democratic Party, Netanyahu wants to continue working.
And there, there are already signs that, that the Biden camp is reaching out in certain ways to Israel. I don't know if you saw the interview in the Times of Israel this morning with Tony Blinken, a top Biden foreign advisor, who said that in order to preserve Israel's qualitative military edge as current U.S. law requires, a Biden administration would have to take a long, hard look at the F-35 sale to the United Emirates. That's kind of interesting, no?
Well, it's interesting in the sense that we had assumed, and we still assume, a Biden administration would not. I think there are steps of that Trump took that they might try to reverse, and the most prominent of which is the Iran nuclear deal. But we all assume that they're quite happy with the normalization with the Gulf countries and that there's no reason for them to interfere, but if they take a hard look at the F-35 sales, that will put a damper on the whole process, because that's the reason that
that was the raison d'être for the whole deal, right?
I suspect that they know and that Trump knows that the UAE is just a harbinger, that Trump in fact plans to sell hundreds of F-35 to countries in the Middle East. That does not fly from their point of view, and they have always been more against introduction of sophisticated weapons to the Middle East. So that could be an issue going forward, the whole normalization deal.
I think that if Biden won't have an interest not to go forward with the normalization deals, but maybe they want to play hardball. Maybe they say Trump gave everything too easy, both to Netanyahu and also maybe to some, the UAE and others on the plains, and they're gonna want to take a fresh look at it. And of course, if they want to go into some kind of negotiations with Iran, they would probably try not to get into too big of a fight with everybody else in the region, but they will have to calculate how they do it. So I really basically is leaving their options open right now.
Yeah, and I'll just add one more thing. I think one of Biden's top priorities, if not, in fact, the top priority, is mending fences with Europe. I know that Biden has been one of the things that troubled him most was the breach between the United States and Europe under Trump. And he will want to quickly reestablish the alliance. And part of reestablishing the alliance is taking into account European views about the conflict here. That has to do with the Iran deal, and it probably has to do with a lot of other issues that relate to settlements and so on. I don't think this is going to be a very high priority for Biden, but he's not going to purposely antagonize Europe as Trump has done several times.
Netanyahu and Israel may want and be praying for and hoping for a Trump victory, but the prime minister has been more cautious this time, right? He rather pointedly sidestepped Trump's invitation to take a swipe at Biden. Is that an indication of how Bibi has grown as a statesman, or that he thinks that Trump's going to lose?
Probably the second, I would assume. That was a very curious incident. We were talking about the phone call where Netanyahu suddenly said, "Yeah, we'll be happy if anyone helps Israel." Which has not gotten the attention I think it deserves. But I think I saw it more as a sort of Netanyahu venting his frustration. Because I'll remind you that on the same day, Israel also announced that it had no objections to the sales of F-35s to the UAE. And I don't think it was a coincidence that it came out on the same day. And I don't think Netanyahu is happy with the sale of, especially when it suddenly turned out that they were selling 50 instead of the 25. I think that the F-35 sale was a diktat that Trump gave to Netanyahu. And when Netanyahu signaled that he wasn't going to, burn Washington down in order to prevent the deal, then the deal went ahead. And I think he's very frustrated by it. And I saw that not only as a signal that he realizes that Biden is just around the corner, but also as his very little payback to Trump for having forced this F-35 deal down his throat.
And Trump was visibly upset.
You could see that he expected Netanyahu maybe to just laugh. I don't think he expected Netanyahu to diss Biden, but Netanyahu could have given a reaction that played into Trump's game. and he shut it down instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like and he did in the Oval Office the previous time, where he also said Sleepy Joe, and Netanyahu just sat there and didn't say anything.
Yep, this was different. And first of all, I think Netanyahu reads polls just like all of us. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have inside information that we don't have. He relies on the same analysis. I think they, you know, what do the people at the Israeli embassy who are supposed to do election analysis actually do? They read 538. You know, I mean, that's how it is. Well, they talk to members of Congress. If they're lucky, they get to see internal polling for congressional races. That sometimes gives you more interesting top lines. But that's pretty much it. So he reached the polls that he was cautious. I agree with Chemi also that from his point of view, the fact that the Sudan deal and the F-35 deal were announced on the same day was not ideal, because he would have preferred it otherwise, to have all the headlines about Sudan right before Shabbat in Israel.
Right. So everybody and then talks bury, about this bury during the weekend. F-35s.
And then the F-35 comes midnight. Out at midnight on, you know, in
a night dump.
Exactly. Ideally on Yom Kippur.
And instead, everybody talked about the F-35. That was the bigger headline here in Israel.
Mm. Well, when you're in the room with Trump, it's not difficult to take the moral high ground, is it? Slightly less cautious than Bibi, according to Israel Hayom, were officials from the UAE and Bahrain, who have come out openly in support for Trump. We hope for Trump's victory, but we're also preparing for the possibility of a new president entering the Oval Office, a senior Emirati diplomat reportedly told the paper. So they're putting all of their eggs into...
I'll just remind you that the UAE is mentioned prominently and repeatedly in the Mueller report about the Russian investigation. The UAE has its fingers there in all sorts of pies that we have not exactly found out exactly what's going on. So I think they were invested in Trump even before 2016. Their investment has paid off, because they've been looking for these F-35s, and I see no reason for them not to support Trump.
I agree, but I also want to remind everyone that... as part of the hacking wars between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, there were emails that were leaked, stolen basically, not leaked, but stolen, and then published probably by Qatari agents, of the Emirati ambassador to Washington, Youssef El Ataiba, corresponding on election night in 2016 with one of Hillary Clinton's closest advisors, and sounding in the emails shocked, and maybe even, I think, afraid that Trump had won the election. Writing these things like, you know, I can't believe this is happening. This can't be real. So I think that, you know, they know how to play the Washington scene better than most countries. Everybody thinks that Israel is this, you know, strongest Middle Eastern country when it comes to Capitol Hill. And it's true, there is AIPAC and there is a strong lobby. And of course, Israel has a lot of public support in the United States. But the UAE, they're also very good at this game. And they can play on both sides of it. And I'm sure that at the same time that they're rooting for Trump, they're also trying to build connections already with the Biden. Not necessarily because they think Biden will win or Trump will win, just because they always want to keep their options on both sides of the aisle.
But I'm not sure that the UAE is particularly happy that Biden, when he comes to the White House, is going to find out all the dirty details of the F-35 deal. I'm not sure that they're looking forward to that.
Well, maybe it won't come to that.
Maybe it won't.
Maybe. So, listen, we're almost out of time. I want to end with Bernie Sanders. He's not running, but we're going to end with him anyway. Last week, he gave a speech about the dangers of bigotry at a memorial for the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, and he included Israel in a list of countries where authoritarianism is on the rise. Let's hear what he had to say.
We have to be clear that while anti-Semitism is a threat to Jews everywhere, it is also a threat to democratic governance itself all over the world, in Russia, in India, in Brazil, in Hungary, in Israel, and elsewhere. We see this rise of a divisive and destructive form of politics. We see intolerant, authoritarian political leaders attacking the very foundations of democratic societies.
Guys, if Trump is the president that Israel wants, could it be that Bernie is the president that Israel needs? In Haaretz today, our colleague Gidon Levy bemoans the fact that in Israel and the United States, the opposition to current leaders has failed to produce a worthy challenger. He describes Biden, in a lovely turn of phrase, as a whiter shade of pale, and says that, like Benny Gantz, here he doesn't represent any great hope for a better tomorrow. Depressing but fair?
No, I don't think so. I think that's a misrepresentation of what moderate Democrats represent. And especially now when they have a more comprehensive, progressive worldview. They're not called progressive, but in American terms, it's a progressive worldview. And I don't think Biden is a person without an agenda. He's a centrist. And people who have strong ideologies on the fringes tend to view centrists as people who have no essence. I don't think that's true. Look, Bernie Sanders is not, first of all, in my opinion, he's not an electable president. And second of all, it's not the he's used harsher phrases about Netanyahu. And I think that the antagonism that Bernie Sanders elicited in Israel, and second of all, that somebody like Netanyahu could drum up, I mean, look what he did to Obama, would make the whole thing counterproductive. I think it's going to be much more difficult for that Netanyahu or for right-wingers to do that to Biden. So in my opinion, Biden, if you look at it even from that narrow prism, Biden is a better president. Mm-hmm. Than Sanders might have been.
I understand Gideon Levy's frustration from the point of view that if the one issue you are most committed to is fighting the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, obviously Sanders is much stronger in his language, in his rhetoric about that issue than Biden, who really is a moderate Democrat with decades of a record of support for Israel and cooperation with Israeli prime ministers from the days of Golda Meir, which is kind of crazy, but true.
Story,
but true. And obviously, you know, I think there was a lot of disappointment in the American left that it was Biden who won the nomination and not Sanders. But I will say one difference, if we're looking at differences between 2020 and 2016, overall, the left has gotten behind Biden much more enthusiastically than they did behind Clinton. We did not see this year the open warfare between the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party and the moderate wing, which is now led by Biden. In 2016, during the Democratic Convention, supporters of Sanders stormed out of the convention and went outside, and some of them even burned Israeli and American flags. It was a crazy scene. When all the stolen emails of the Clinton campaign were being leaked, and there was a lot of just, you know, people commenting in bad ways about Bernie Sanders and the whole story of the debate questions that were given to Hillary in advance. You remember those scandals? People who supported the Sanders were making a huge noise about this. We're not seeing anything like that today. Most of the American left is giving its support to Biden. We're seeing Bernie Sanders campaigning for him, AOC campaigning for him. I think she wrote, as we are speaking this morning, that she commanded an operation of 100,000 phone calls into Texas, to Hispanic voters in Texas. There is much more unity on the Democratic side. The flip side of that, by the way, is that also on the Republican side, much more of the party is behind Trump than in 2016, when there were a lot of divisions and Republicans who were, you know, much more spoken against him. And we'll see how all of that impacts the results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the difference is, though, that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is still strong and will continue to function no matter what happens. And the Republican Party, I'm not sure there are two wings anymore.
It's just Trump.
The other wing has been
Eliminated. Of the party. It's out of the party, basically. Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're leaving. That's true.
Yeah. Guys, on that note, we'll wrap things up for today. Many thanks to Chemi Shalev, to Amir Tibon, and to stand-in producer Amir Factor. We'll be back again on Wednesday with Aloof Ben, Anshul Pfeffer, and Noah Landau for a special post-election pod. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.